This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Hugh Remington. Welcome to the Roundtable. Now, an Australian defence corridor is among the senior people who spend their days reflecting on what future wars might look like and how we should prepare for them. There's been quite a bit of chatter in recent days over a provocative question put out there by a very senior member of the club. Should Australia consider getting nuclear weapons? And even if someone was all for it, there would of course be no easy or immediate path to that goal. A great many people, naturally, even the most hawkish circles of the military establishment, don't want anything to do with nuclear weapons. But the author of a new book in which the idea is floated, Hugh White, is making no apologies for raising the question. He wants us talking, so let's talk about the risks that might be developing around us. At the roundtable today is Hugh White, Emeritus Professor at the Australian National University and the author of a new book, How to Defend Australia. Michael Shoebridge is the Director of the Defence and Strategy Program at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, ASPI. And Dr. Stefan Frühling is the Associate Professor in Strategic and Defence Studies at the Coral Bell School of Asia Pacific Affairs at the ANU. Hello to all of you.
Hello. Hi, Hugh. Great to be with you.
And you. Now, Hugh White, if I can start with you, I have a feeling that some people listening to this conversation, sitting at home, will immediately groan at the thought of a bunch of men, let's face it, sitting around talking about what weapons we need for the future. They might ask, haven't we, as human beings, moved past the notion of war? Why? What would you say to that question, Hugh White?
Well, the first thing I'd say is it's a very good question to ask because, as your intro suggested, a lot of our discussion about defence does tend to take place within a bit of a closed circle of people who tend to take a whole lot of things for granted, which maybe we shouldn't take for granted. So I do think we have to be careful in the way we analyse the way the international system is going to see whether our old assumptions are still right. Regrettably, I think they are. Regrettably, I don't think there's any reason for us to believe that the role of armed force in international affairs in coming decades is going to be any less than it has been in the past. Now, of course, that depends partly on how far back we look. If we look back even the last sort of two or three decades, you do see some significant events, obviously a lot of wars in the Middle East and so on. What you don't see is major conflicts between major powers. And what I'm focusing on in the book are the implications for Australia for that kind of thing. And there, I guess I just put it this way. If we look back 50 years, we haven't seen many wars between major powers. But there's no reason for us to assume that the next 50 years is going to look like the last 50 years or like the 50 years before that. And that's partly because, in the bottom line, I don't really see there's much evidence for a Whiggish view of history that somehow international society, and you might even say human nature, is gradually getting better and better as time passes. We keep on making the same old mistakes, and I think we must regretfully recognise that and prepare for that possibility, particularly in the Asia of the next few decades.
So the most obvious potential that we would see in our region for a great power conflict is between the United States and a rising China. What form, Hugh White, as you write this new book about how we defend Australia in this, what form do you think that kind of conflict, should it happen, what form might it take?
Well, I think if we see a US-China conflict, it will be driven fundamentally by the very deep competition between America and China for which of them will be the primary power in Asia. And that kind of contest has traditionally been the thing that sparks the biggest and worst wars, what the scholars call the hegemonic wars. So I think we shouldn't allow ourselves to optimistically assume that a clash between America and China would just be a little one-day wonder. My own view of how that would play out is that because China's capacity to fight at sea has improved so strongly over the last couple of decades in particular, America would find it very hard to score a quick, easy win in a maritime conflict with China. What would most likely happen is that after a couple of weeks, there'd be a stalemate in which both sides had lost lots of ships and aircraft and lots of people, but neither had achieved a decisive result. The pressure on both sides then to escalate the conflict would be very high. It's spreading at both in intensity and in geographical extent, and the risk of that crossing the nuclear threshold, I think, are also very high. Nobody quite knows what the threshold for nuclear escalation in an Asia-Pacific conflict would be, but I think we should not assume that it's very low, and the fact that it's unclear makes that risk all the higher. So I do think a US-China conflict would risk becoming very catastrophic. And one of the reasons why I'm pessimistic about the future of the US role in Asia is I don't think in the end America is going to be prepared to risk that, which is why I think there's a strong chance the US, to avoid that, will end up pulling out of Asia, notwithstanding all the tough rhetoric we're seeing out of Washington at the moment.
Hugh, I wonder if it's worth, just before we dive further into a cataclysmic China-US conflict, just getting back to that first point to say, what's happening in the world that we see at the moment is a return of empowered, coercive, authoritarian regimes. And that's not just China. It certainly is China as a one-party communist state. It's growing and exerting all national power, including its military, and using that quite coercively, as we can see in the South China Sea and even closer to us. But Russia also, you know, if this was a European conversation, you'd be hearing the same things about the willingness of Russia under Putin to use its military power coercively. And you can certainly see that in Crimea and in Ukraine, and even you could extend that to the Middle East and that intervention into Syria. So I think, you know, back to that original point of, is war so last season? Well, unfortunately not. With the rise of coercive authoritarian actors in the world willing to use their power, this is something we do need to think about and work to prevent.
So what do you think are the prospects that it might come to a military clash, even one as dire as Hugh has just mapped out there, Michael Shoebridge?
Well, I think this really starts to revolve around some of the big issues Hugh canvasses in his book. But I'd say it's not just the US and China. The Indo-Pacific and broader Asia, or greater Asia, is really heading into what people have called for some time a multipolar world. So the rise of India is slower than the rise of China, but it is happening. That country has been experiencing high rates of growth with an enormous population and enormous human capital for some years now.
There's no one imagining at the moment any war involving India that might draw us in, or any conflict involving India that might draw us in. Whereas there is a lot of talk about a conflict with China that might draw us in. Stefan Frühling, what do you think are the dangers of such a war that would draw us in?
Well, I think Hugh raises an important question about what would such a conflict look like. And I think the key here is the question of how likely is it that any kind of military clash or confrontation would escalate to all-out war. I'm probably less convinced of Hugh that these dangers are as cataclysmic, in the sense that what we see on both, certainly on the Chinese side, and I think increasingly on the US side, is a willingness to use military force in a limited way for limited aims. We are not in the Cold War of old, where we had two systems which were ideologically opposed to the point that ultimately the existence of one threatened the existence of the other. So I think war aims will be more limited, and I think that means also that the dangers of escalation are probably less, I would say, than Hugh might see. But that actually means that probably the danger of conflict, of limited conflict, is greater than might often be assumed.
What are the risks, do you think, as we see China that's laid out these artificial islands, it has militarized these artificial islands in the East China Sea and the South China Sea, even though it said it would not militarize them, and it is now showing every sign of wanting to defend those islands and to challenge American ships that come nearby. It looks to me as if there is a very high risk over time, Stefan Frühling, that around those islands, if nowhere else, there's a probability of some sort of miscalculation, or at least some sort of limited clash.
Well, I think we could see some miscalculation and limited clash. That doesn't necessarily mean that would kind of go much further. And one of the advantages of maritime conflict, I think, is that even a limited clash is more easily contained. But what we have seen in Chinese, the way that China has used force since the Communist Party came to power is in short, intensive, but limited conflicts. In Korea, teaching Vietnam a lesson, taking islands in the South China Sea from Vietnam. And I think that that kind of behavior of a short, sharp, but ultimately politically motivated use of force that's designed to teach, if you like, other countries a lesson, but not necessarily change territorial boundaries, is something that we need to contemplate. And that use of force poses quite difficult like challenges to counter, but ultimately the dangers of that escalating, I think, to all-out conflict are not as big as if we, for example, look at a scenario over Taiwan.
Hugh White, what are the dangers that China at some point will want to teach us a lesson?
Well, I think that's a very important question for us to consider. I don't think that the risks of that in the short term are very high, but almost nothing to do with defence policy focuses on the short term. When we think about the kind of armed forces Australia needs, we need to look 20 or 30 or even 40 years ahead. And so we have to ask ourselves, what are the chances of the China of 20 or 30 or 40 years from now doing that? And I think there are a couple of factors to bear in mind. The first is, what kind of role will China play in Asia? And because I'm pessimistic about the future of American power in Asia, I think the chances of China ending up as the dominant power, at least in East Asia and the Western Pacific, are pretty high. And then the question is, well, what kind of power would China be when it has that kind of role? And although I don't think China today is as aggressive or hegemonistic as, for example, the Soviet Union was in its heyday, it's still pretty assertive, and it could easily become more assertive in future. So I think if we find ourselves living in an Asia or an East Asia dominated by China, in which China becomes more and more determined to have its way, then the chances that an Australia that was not willing to conform to China's wishes on some particular issue might find itself facing military pressure. As Stefan mentioned, the old model of teaching Vietnam a lesson, I don't think that's something we can dismiss. I think it is a clear possibility, not a high possibility, but a clear possibility, and one that, as I'm saying in the book, I'm urging Australians to think, well, what kind of steps would we want to be able to take in order to be able to prevent China from doing that?
How would nuclear weapons help us, Hugh White?
Look, it's a really important question, and I just want to stress that although the book does address the question of nuclear weapons very clearly, I neither predict nor advocate that Australia should get nuclear weapons, but I do think we need to look at the question again. And that's because for many decades, for 50 years, Australia has forsworn the idea of developing nuclear weapons itself because we've been very confident that the US would effectively counter any nuclear threat against Australia. Now, if I'm right that we can no longer assume that US power in Asia is going to remain anything like as strong as it has been, particularly 20 or 30, 40 years down the track, then I don't think we can be as confident as we have been about American support against a nuclear threat. And that means Australia itself has to ask, Do we think that we need, therefore, to be able to protect ourselves against a nuclear threat? And if the answer is yes, then I think the most logical, the most obvious, perhaps not the only way to respond to that, is to develop a minimum nuclear deterrent capability of our own. Now, that would be a terribly serious step to take, terribly serious diplomatically, terribly serious financially, and I think actually very serious morally. And that's why I'm not advocating it, but I do think that's a question we as a country are going to need to address more clearly if I'm correct that it becomes clear that the United States plays a less significant role in Asia than we've been used to in the past.
And if we were to do that, would the logical step be to put a nuclear warhead on our submarines?
Look, I think, and I do discuss this in the book, the kind of nuclear posture that I think Australia should adopt is one that the strategists call a minimum deterrent posture. The only circumstances under which in such a posture you'd aim to use your nuclear weapons is to threaten retaliation against an attacker for a nuclear attack on Australia. That kind of capability needs to be very survivable, and therefore I think you're right, the best way to do it would be to do as the French and the British do, for example, is to keep their minimum deterrent forces on submarines deployed at sea.
Michael Shoebridge, your thoughts?
Well, Hugh, I think we've got to be careful about going on a slippery dip of assumptions there. To assess that China only wants to dominate in East Asia and therefore America has less resolved to contest that is one thing. To then slip on to, so America's not going to play a significant strategic role in Greater Asia, a huge expanse of the globe, is an entirely different thing. And you need to go down that slippery dip of assumptions to end up seriously considering independent nuclear weapons for Australia. I think you look at President Trump, probably the most isolationist instinct president in a long time. Where's he spending his time? With China, with North Korea. American interests are deeply engaged in Asia, including in East Asia, and that is unlikely to change. And American resolve is another thing we haven't talked about. America's the only country in the world that's used nuclear weapons in conflict, and it did so in East Asia. So I think the fundamental assumptions need to be very carefully tested. And then, were Australia to get nuclear weapons, that would be the end of a much darker world, because it would have been a domino of Japan and South Korea and others. And we'd have to think, would that provoke Indonesia too?
So you're saying we would only look at nuclear weapons if, in fact, we're living in a world where the Japanese have got them, the South Koreans have calculated that they need them as well?
And then it's a much more dangerous world. It's a Hobbesian world of state against state. You know, it's like state of origin comes to nuclear weapons, and that is plain unhealthy. So a much better strategy is to be clear about America's continuing role and resolve and test that. But I think the grounds for expecting American power to remain a primary contributor, not the dominant contributor, but a primary contributor to Asian security and our own security, are strong. And that's driven partly by the coercive nature of the Chinese state.
I think one of the questions here is also, what are nuclear weapons for? And in my view, nuclear weapons are the great equalizer. They're the weapons of the weak, not of the strong. And I think in the world that Hugh describes, China would actually have very little need to threaten us with nuclear weapons, and a lot of disincentives, in the sense that the reason China has nuclear weapons is because they were at the receiving end of US nuclear coercion back in the 1950s. And China has always been very comfortable having very limited nuclear arsenal in order to counter that, which shows us that the Chinese think that even a limited arsenal has very significant strategic effects. And the Chinese have very little incentive in pushing us in that way. So I think that the way that nuclear weapons will enter, and I think they will enter our strategic discourse and policy a lot sooner than we might even contemplate, the question of Australian nuclear weapons, is in the question of how do we use U.S. nuclear weapons and the prospect of nuclear escalation to manage nuclear conflict or conflict in Asia and manage those dangers of escalation. And ultimately, I agree with Hugh that the trends in conventional balance of forces are not looking good if you look at Asia from the U.S. and its ally side. And I think that will be the reason that will push us to more seriously contemplate how nuclear weapons play into the balance of forces in Asia overall, not necessarily nuclear forces.
Might one option short of us getting nuclear weapons on our own be to try to bind even closer to the United States and perhaps invite the United States, should it come to this, to station bombers, nuclear weapons capable bombers in northern Australia, or perhaps even some of their submarine fleet in our waters? Is that a realistic sort of alternative to getting weapons ourselves of this type, Hugh White?
Look, I don't think it is, Hugh, because I don't think it addresses what I see as being the fundamental problem. And of course, this is the issue that the debate I'm having with Michael, and it's a very important debate to have. You know, we've got to be very careful about assumptions, as he says, but we do have to make a judgment about how confident we are about continuing nuclear US commitment to Asia. And if I'm right that the US commitment to Asia cannot be relied upon, then there's no particular reason for the United States to want to base forces in Australia, or even if it has them, for them to be a sufficient driver for the United States to be willing to engage in a large-scale conflict in Asia on Australia's behalf. I think we need to, in other words, emancipate ourselves from what is for Australians a very deeply embedded assumption that one way or another the Americans will always be there for us. They have been in the past, up to a point, but that has been a product of a particular period of history when America was overwhelmingly preponderant, both economically and strategically, where the costs to America of sustaining its position in Asia were relatively low and the challenges were very low as well. Now we're in an era in which US preponderance of power is much lower and will continue to get lower in the future. And the scale of the challenge posed, particularly by China, is much bigger. And if that's right, then I don't think there's any sort of formulation or any basing model for that matter that would give us a high level of confidence that the United States would be there for us. And that's why we have to start asking the hard question as to what we can do for ourselves.
So, Michael Shoebridge, if you look at the US presidential race as it's starting to shape up for next year, Donald Trump plainly fancies himself at least a fair chance to get re-elected, and he's put out on the record there, it's been part of his program, that he doesn't want to get involved in a whole bunch of loser wars, as he sees that his predecessors have done. But if you look at the Democratic side, there's a very wide and open field of people who are jockeying for that Democratic Party nomination. But if you look at them, there's, apart from perhaps Joe Biden, not many of them seem remotely engaged or interested in an interventionist US military stance, as might have happened in the past. Doesn't that really feed into Hugh White's concerns that there's nowhere in the horizon coming out of the United States that sense of that assertive American military positioning that we might have seen in decades past?
No, I think that phenomenon is an entirely different thing. That's that wars of choice, Iraq and Afghanistan, war on terror through military means, regime change. Really, both sides of American politics understand America's economic interests are tied up in Asia, and economic interests drag in strategic interests. I mean, this is actually the backstory for China. The Belt and Road Initiative, investments throughout Asia and into Africa and into Europe, those economic interests are dragging in China's strategic interests. That's why we're sitting here having this conversation on top of the coercive nature of the Chinese state. So American economic interests are intertwined with Asia. And that's why, as I say, Trump, one of the most isolationist presidents, that's where he's spending his time. And the Democratic side of the US understands that economic engagement as well. That will continue to drag in strategic engagement. I think we've got to get over the idea of a US primacy is what's required or America goes home. America's not Lego Batman. You know, I work alone, and if it doesn't work, I get back to the Batcave. They will continue to be dragged into engagement in Asia because that's where their economic and broader national interests are.
I agree. And I think that if you look at the way that U.S. policy has waxed and waned since the Second World War, it's less swings between isolationism and engagement than the question of where the U.S. should engage and in what way. And I think we've seen that, for example, with Vietnam, which was an overextension of U.S. power and an overcommitment that was not warranted given the strategic interest at stake, in at least in hindsight. And we've seen something similar happen now in the last decade in the Middle East. But what happened after Vietnam is quite instructive because the U.S. refocused on what it generally saw as its core strategic interests in the world. So you actually saw a re-engagement in U.S. Alliances, certainly in Europe and also in Northeast Asia. And I think that with what we're seeing at the moment is something similar in the U.S. system, in the sense that there's a widespread aversion in the U.S., both in the public and in the political sphere on both sides, against and like overextension of U.S. power. But I think that that's not quite the same as saying that the U.S. is willing to walk away from interests that it has long considered very vital to itself.
If we move on from those issues, if you like, of where we should be with a nuclear stance to a more domestic spend just on ordinary defense areas, Donald Trump has said, and he's probably right, that the American umbrella has allowed its allies to slacken off on their own defense spending. He has indicated those days are gone. We're going to have to pay our way. You're suggesting, Hugh White, a significant increase in our defense spending is now required, or should certainly be seriously considered, from about 2% of GDP to up to 3.5% of GDP. Why do you make the argument?
Well, my case on that is not because Donald Trump is asking us to do it, although you're right, he is. It's that if Australia faces a significant decline in US strategic commitment in Asia, then Australia has to ask itself what it can do to defend ourselves independently without depending on the United States. Now, this is something we've never really tried to do before, because we've always, in the end, assumed that the United States saw before the United States, Britain would be there for us. So one of the things I set out to do in the book was to ask the question, well, can we defend ourselves? what would be the cheapest and most cost-effective way of doing it, and how much would that cost? Does it provide a kind of an input to a debate about whether, if we do lose our confidence in US support, we should set out to try and defend ourselves independently or just give up and hope for the best? So my 3.5% of GDP figure is the calculation that I make about the amount you'd have to spend to build the forces required to be able to meet a minimum set of Australian strategic objectives independently without relying on the United States or another great power.
Now, and what would those future forces look like?
Well, the heart of the argument is that Australia needs to focus primarily on what I call a strategy of maritime denial. That is, we take advantage of our geography, which is not just that Australia is an island, but that all the countries surrounding us are islands, and that the most important thing for us to be able to do is to stop an adversary projecting power by sea against us. And it sort of seems kind of obvious, but actually at the moment, a lot of the expenditure in Australia's defence posture is designed to allow us to project power by sea against other people. I think that's going to be very hard for us to do. It's not just that it doesn't work with the geography, but the trends of technology are such that preventing other people projecting power by sea is much easier than projecting power yourself.
So planes and subs?
It's a very big focus on submarines, a very big focus on aircraft, both crewed and uncrewed, a big focus on anti-ship systems of all kinds, but a very small focus on surface ships and on the big amphibious ships, the sort that we've been buying in recent decades. So I would spend a lot less money on surface ships, a lot more money on a bigger fleet of submarines, which I'd hope to acquire quickly, more money on a bigger Air Force designed to ensure that we can use the airspace ourselves for our maritime denial posture and use aircraft to find and attack hostile shipping.
Michael Shoebridge?
Well, I think back to the policy, maritime denial is the way Hughes described it, but a part of it is also where he says we should treat India, Japan and Indonesia both as potential adversaries and maybe as regional partners in coalitions against an aggressive China. Well, I don't think it's a good policy basis to treat people you want as partners as potential enemies. So I think rather than treating those countries as experiments we've got to watch, it's our job to make them deep strategic partners. That affects things like the force structure and the force posture, because you can't build a force that has no presence with the partners you're working with and only pops a periscope up occasionally.
We need to be better friends with India, with Indonesia.
Indonesia, with Japan.
And what about Vietnam, for example, which seems very keen to make friends and is strategically placed?
Yes, they've got a proud history of acting in their own sovereign interests, and they share a lot of interests with us. You know, certainly on freedom of navigation through the South China Sea and not having China seize other countries' territory through militarization. Now, obviously, this is a whole different approach to collective defence rather than a break glass, Australia is a hard target approach. But I think that is a much better strategic policy to have. That doesn't mean we shouldn't spend more on defence. I think we'll have to, because it's becoming a more dangerous world, as we are all discussing. And having more independent means to exert Australian national power and protect Australian interests and contribute to these regional partners' defence, which is in our interests. I think that's a bit in Hughes' proposal that he really discounts.
Okay, well, we are out of time, unfortunately, but Hugh White, you wanted to start a discussion. We're very happy to continue one here on RN. I really do appreciate your time today. Hugh White, Emeritus Professor at Australian National University and the author of his new book, How to Defend Australia. Michael Shoebridge, the last voice you heard there, the Director of the Defence and Strategy Program at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. And also in the mix, Dr. Stefan Frühling, Associate Professor in the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre of the Coral Bell School of Asia Pacific Affairs at ANU. Thank you, all of you, for your time.
Thanks very much, Hugh. Thanks, much appreciated.
And that's all we have time for. Thank you for listening. I'm Hugh Rimmington. Until next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.